always after a very satisfying meal, I'm put in mind of the there were two little British kids who from almost from birth were great rivals. They were bright kids. And it was nip and tuck all the way through. One went to Oxford, one went to Cambridge, and they vied with each other for honors. When they graduated from the university, one went into the British Navy, and his brilliance catapulted him right to the top in due time. The other entered the British Church, and he was catapulted right to the top because of his talent in due time. However, from the day they graduated from the university, they didn't see each other for the next 25 years. One advanced and became an admiral in the British Navy, and the other became the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, the Archbishop, as he grew in wisdom and age and grace before God and man, also grew in girth. He gave birth to a huge pot belly. After 25 years, they met quite by accident in the train station in London. And the Archbishop, in his red cassock, flowing robes, and huge front, spotted the admiral first. And he went up behind him and touched him on the shoulder. And when his friend turned around, he gasped in surprise. But before he could say anything, the admiral said, or the Archbishop said, "Son, would you put my bags on that train over there?" And the admiral looked at him, and he looked at the front on him, and he said, "Madam, in your condition, you shouldn't be traveling at all." A year ago last September, I had the privilege of talking at Blackstone, and I don't know why it is, but fear always dogs the step of the alcoholic. Me, even since sobriety. I am scared right now. I hope you will bear with me till I get airborne. And I hope the way I feel changes as the evening goes on. But anyway, I felt exactly this way at Blackstone, and I asked Tom Hampton, who asked me to come there, "Well, what is it that you want me to talk about?" And Tom, in that magnificent, gentle, soothing way of his, says, "I don't give a damn what you talk about as long as you tell some dialect stories." So he's a Protestant layman like Sid here, and I thought I'd wing a doozy off in the beginning, and I told him about the... This story has a southern setting. I hope you enjoy it. It appears that on one side of the street was a Seventh-day jump-and-twirl-around Orthodox church, and across the street was a Seventh-day jump-and-twirl-around Reformed church. And there was a local priest who happened to spot the minister walking out of the Reformed church, and he said, "Reverend, while you're here," he said, "this, well, it hasn't bothered me, but it's been a source of wonder." He said, "Obviously, one of these churches came from the other. The Reformed came from the Orthodox." He said, "Could you tell me the difference?" "Oh, yeah," he said, "theological difference." He said, "You see, over there in the Orthodox church, they say that Pharaoh's daughter say that she found that little baby, Moses, in the bulrushes. And we say that's what she said." Some years back during Prohibition, there was a very young Irish priest came over from Ireland to work in Boston, the Archdiocese of Boston, and it was during Prohibition. And this was his first Saturday in the confessional. He was scared to death. My God, he was scared. He figured that he was going to get murder and slap on the Pope and all that sort of thing. He didn't know what in the world to do. But the confessions were very ordinary and normal. Pulled out, the fifth guy came in, and he said this. He finished his litany of little sins and so on. He wound up by saying, "And besides that, Father, I'm a bootlegger." And his heart went cold. He had never heard the word in his life. He was only about 3 weeks from the books, fresh from the books. And he just was stunned in the silence. He didn't know what it was serious. He didn't know what kind of a penance to give the guy. And he just sat there. Well, after a while, the silence became embarrassing. And the man coughed. And he said, "Excuse me for a minute." And the fellow said, "Certainly, huh?" And he walked to the other side of the church where there was an old Irish pastor hearing confession. So he knocked on the door of the box. And the old man opened up and said, "What is it, boy?" "Well," he says, "Father, I got a bootlegger over there." He says, "What do I give him?" He says, "Not more than a dollar and a half a pint." Sure about the alcoholic priest was hearing confessions. Now, to show you how easy it is, now, I honestly don't know whether there's any point to these stories or not, but I'll try to find one if he can get it. This priest was hearing confessions when a young nun came in to go to confession, and as she was coming in, she tripped. Now, this is the missing fact. He did not know she was a nun. Just to show you how judgment can be so erroneous without the pertinent facts. Trying to be kind, he simply said, well, what's wrong? She said, oh, I'm sorry, Father, I'm just so nervous. So trying to be helpful, he said, well, what do you have to be nervous about? She said, well, it's all my children. The poor thing taught the second grade. It was about April, you know. They were dying for vacation. They were driving her crazy. Well, he says, how many children do you have? And when she said 45, he said, get the hell out of here. I thought you were drunk when you fell in. By the way, she was the same nun that was walking down the street with a companion, and there was a drunk walking up, and he's weaving all over the place. They didn't know how they were going to get around him, see? So when he got right to them, they separated and went around, and he stopped and blinked. Said, now, how in the hell did she do that? That's a sleeper for those of you with single vision. He was the same guy that got caught the day before riding down wrong way on a one-way street. And a cop jumped all over him. He says, good God, man, you're going to kill somebody. He said, didn't you see the arrows? Guys, the arrows, I didn't even see the Indian. Now that I've got you all in a serious vein, my name is Father Martin. I'm an alcoholic. And I would like to tell you something of myself. For the simplest reason in the world, you know, before every meeting, we two in the Baltimore area read a prologue. And ours says the equivalent of what yours does. We have adopted a program which has for its purpose sobriety for ourselves, help for other alcoholics who desire it, and a few other things, it seems. Time after time, I have heard in AA this statement. I'm sure you've heard it, and perhaps because you have heard it, maybe you have said it. And it wasn't until last summer that I learned that it was not altogether true. The most important person in this room is the new man. The hell he is. I am. I am. He comes second. He comes second. And I must never forget this. I came close to losing my life because of it. I'm here for me. If incidentally I can help you, thanks be to God. But if sobriety for myself does not come first, help for others will not come second. I wonder why Bill Wilson said, grab this. First things come first. The alcoholic's brain has been compared to a BB shot rattling around in a shoebox. How accurate. Many of us have or had false ideas about alcoholism. What I know about it, I learned in AA and since. I'll tell you a story that can illustrate perfectly mistakes that can be made because of misinformation. And face it, in the field of alcoholism, tragedy results from mistakes. There was an old Chinese gentleman who was very irate over the fact that someone had tossed his outhouse over the hill. He called his two young sons in to ask them if they knew anything about it. They didn't. And he sat them down. He said, would like to tell you little story of American boy named George Washington, who one day chopped down Papa San Washington cherry tree with hatchet. Papa San Washington called him in, asking him if he knew anything about cherry tree. Georgie said, Papa San, no can I tell right. It was I who chopped down your cherry tree with hatchet. Papa San Washington pat him on head, give him cookie for to tell the truth. One of the little kids pops up and says, Papa San, it was I who threw your outhouse over here, and the old man nearly killed him. Now when this boy came to, he stood up and said, Papa Sanfo, why you tell story of virtue get reward? George Washington get cookie for to tell the truth. I tell the truth, you whip me. So why? And the old man pointed out, he said, only one thing different between the story. When
George Washington, Capitan Papa San Washington, Chelly Tree. Papa San Washington, not in Chelly Tree.
People have looked upon alcoholism from 1,000 different points of view, and yet they say that the eyewitness is the worst. You ever hear the story of the orchestra leader at a society wedding who stopped the waltz right in the middle of the music and whirled around in total anger at the people? He said, "Who called my piccolo player an SOB?" And some lush in the back of the room said, "Who called that SOB a piccolo player?" Two people looking at exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. And so there are many, many, many different views and viewpoints and opinions. What I say here tonight are mine. I don't care to argue about them because I don't think, in my mind, they are arguable. They have saved my life, and I will stick with them. They say you must learn to like a martini. I learned very quickly. Thanksgiving Day, 1948. The Thanksgiving after I was ordained, I was stationed out west in Mountain View, California. And this was our first free day, and four of us from the faculty went down to Santa Cruz for the day. From the very beginning, I could not and still cannot stand drunkenness. My father drank at home and left a god-awful taste in the mouths of the whole family because of it. And yet, as my drinking progressed very gradually, I found out that it was beginning to get a hold on me. I simply couldn't understand why people chose to drink too much. Couldn't understand. I have found out since they don't choose. But anyway. By the way, if you're expecting anything spectacular, forget it. I never roller skated out on the altar or showed up to hear confessions in my shorts or anything like that. Perfectly normal alcoholic drinker, whatever that means. As years went by, I drank for 10 years. And by the way, you know, looking back on it in the beginning of my sobriety, I tried to see, and there were, I enjoyed drinking. I drank quite moderately, almost over moderately in the beginning, and I enjoyed it. Caused no trouble to anyone. But of course, that's the clue. When drinking begins to cause problems, then it's one. And that's what an alcoholic is, one who drinks that way. But anyway, after I got sober, I looked back and figured that I drank 5 years in a controlled way and five in an increasingly uncontrolled and uncontrollable way. As I got a little more well, the ratio went maybe 6 years of alcoholic drinking and four social drinking. A couple of years ago, I had it down to 7 and 3. It went to 8 and 2, and it's batting about 9 to 1 now. Because the more you focus in on the hard reality, that is, the more I do, I can see vague beginnings very early. I was hospitalized in San Francisco for alcoholism for 3 weeks in St. Mary's Hospital. Get a load of this. The day I left, I cut myself shaving with an electric shaver. I'm still trying to figure that one out. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. That summer when I got back home, I didn't know what I was in the hospital for. I knew my nerves were killing me. Sure they were. I was shaking to pieces. And the doctor referred to alcohol, but he never once used the word alcoholism. He was a very wise man. He knew his own limitations. He came in the room one day and he said, "Father, if someone were to come to you with a moral problem that you could not handle or didn't know the answer to, what would you do?" I said, "I'd ask their permission to get the answer, to present their case as a hypothetical case to some expert theologian." He said, suppose you couldn't come up with it then. I said, "Well, I don't know. I guess I'd send them to a pro who could handle it." "Well," he said, "now I don't know anything about drinking." And it was a gentle way of his suggesting I undergo psychiatric treatment. We know in AA But the treatment the alcoholic needs is treatment that will attain sobriety. We don't need a psychiatrist. We need to be sober to find out if we need a psychiatrist. Sounds funny, but it isn't. It isn't. I always say to people, somehow or other, if I go to a man to find out why I drink, there will be some magic that will prevent the drinking. What sense does it make for me to go to a dentist and say, Doc, my tooth is killing. Tell me why it hurts. And he writes it out. This is why it hurts, because of the molecular action of the enzymes in the saliva and so on and so forth. And you say, thanks, Doc, Walker. Under some ridiculously insane notion that a knowledge of why it hurts will make it stop hurting. Yet we do this with the alcoholic. Again, what sense does it make for a psychiatrist to walk into an operating room and try psychiatric therapy on a person half anesthetized? You say he needs help himself. Get the man sober. That's the name of this game. Then you'll find out if he needs help. And the man who taught me all I know about alcoholism said this: if you were nuts before you started to drink, you'll be a little flaky after you stop. They have found out that the same percentage of people who have the illness of alcoholism need psychiatric therapy as non-alcoholics. In other words, approximately 7 to 10% of the entire population needs help. Anyway, that summer when I found out that I had been hospitalized for alcoholism, I nearly fell off the Christmas tree. I never dreamed. Never dreamed. And so I was sent back to Baltimore, where I have been ever since, and spent the two most miserable years of my life, because it was there that I tried to stop drinking and found I couldn't. You know, we learn in AA that between drinks 7 and 8, freedom is gone. I humbly submit that you have no freedom even before the first, even when you're physically sober, if you're an alcoholic and if therapy is not proper. In other words, to put it simply, the farther away you are from your last drink, the closer you are to your next one. It is simply a question of time, unless and until therapy is proper. I could not understand why, after a month's sobriety, I would buy a bottle and take it back to my room. Couldn't understand it. I know now. I was addicted to it. You know why the alcoholic drinks? Now you can save all your psychiatric fees, unless you want a little bit of background knowledge. But you want to know why the alcoholic drinks? Because he's an alcoholic. That's why. The alcoholic drinks because he's addicted. That's what we mean by an alcoholic. And the addict drinks because he can't not drink. And so the alcoholic drinks simply because he is one. In other words, were you to find out and remove all those things that caused your alcoholism, you still couldn't drink because your body is physically addicted to the drug. And so it makes much sense to say the alcoholic drinks because he is one. Now that all of that academic barnyard sauce is out of the way, now let's zero in, try to save this life. I was starting to get scared because I was wondering what was happening to me. One time, God rest his soul, Father McDonald, my superior, always acted toward me like a father, kindly and gentle and yet sometimes stern. I remember one time he came to school to ask the faculty's decision on something. I had bought a fifth the night before, had drunk most of it, and nibbled on the rest of it that day, knowing he was coming that night and knowing he can smell it at 80 yards. We went to the faculty room. They set me next to him. As soon as it was over, I shot out of there. Well, he sent for me, and very tearfully, he asked about the drinking and so on and so forth. A short while later, my first Christmas back home, my home is in Baltimore, he called the 18th of December. I remember it very well because we got out on the 20th for Christmas. And he said, how are you? And I nearly fell to pieces. I shook for the next 2 days. He said, I'd like to see you when school breaks up. I was scared. I mean, terribly scared. Well, I went out to see him. And he says, how are you? I said, all right. He said, have you been drinking lately? I said, no. Now, you see, I knew I was lying. And he knew I was lying. And I knew that he knew I was lying. And yet I couldn't not lie. Well, ultimately, he said, we're going to send you away. And with that, a huge weight was lifted from me. Unlike most alcoholics, I was seeking an answer, but nobody had it. Thank God nobody asked me the questions. I'd have died of fear. But, you know, like, where's your self-respect? Hellfire, the alcoholic's been looking for it for the last 8 years. Why don't you drink like other people? I had been trying every time I picked up a glass. So he sent me to a place called Guest House in Lake Orion. And I met the man who runs it, Rip, on a Sunday afternoon. And within 10 minutes, I felt closer to this man than I ever felt to anyone else. And he said to me the thing, I believe, that facilitated my getting well. He said, "Father, I know all about your education and your background. It didn't work, did it?" I said, "No." He said, "Leave your brains right outside that door." Now, I offer that for what it's worth. I have never met a man too stupid to get sober, but I've met plenty too smart to. Too often our brains get in our way. Health, wealth, and brains are the alcoholic's worst enemies because he never knows how to use anything right. He said, "If you want to get well," he handed me a list of 12 things to do. They're written in the past tense because they've been done and they've been found to work. He said, "Don't question, do them." For those of you who are new to the program, do the steps, then talk about them. Thank God there's more hot air wasted or disseminated through AA rooms on the part of jackasses that don't know what they're talking about. Damn it, you're playing with my life when you talk. I wish they hadn't even know what you're talking about. So Rip would explain these steps, and then he sent us off to AA meetings. Basically, that was the therapy. The 12 steps of recovery, this is AA. The paradoxes of alcohol and alcoholism. You know what alcohol is? The liquid. You know what a liquid is? It's a substance that takes the shape of its container. It doesn't even have shape of its own. And yet it controlled me, body and soul. She's the most relentless of all pursuers. She holds out the world in the palm of her hand and gives the opposite of what she promises. Yet I drank. "I'll make you 10 feet tall," she reduced me to having to jump to touch bottom. But I drank. "I will make you king," she reduces us to court jester. Yet we drink. "I will give you sleep," for a while she does, then robs us of it. Yet we drink. "I'll relieve your nerves," and then she creates her own. Yet we drink. Proof positive of the illness, disease concept of this insidious thing. We do what we would not. And under its influence, those things that we would not, those we do. How do we conquer her? Face it, every one of us has fought her. Everyone. And we've lost. What sense does it make for a boxer 135 pounds to step into a ring with a 200 pounder day after day after day, get his brain scrambled, and climb in the next day? That's what we do in our bouts with the bottle. And so AA says, give up. Just quit. You can't beat her. Admit your powerlessness over alcohol, that your life had become unmanageable, and you can start. Ladies and gentlemen, it's only when we admit our hopelessness that we cease to be helpless. We can now be helped. I always say, give in or you'll cave in. We must surrender to win. We lose a battle to win the war. There is a certain freedom about this first, truly humble act of the alcoholic. I maintain that the path to true humility is through humiliation. And when he admits truth, there is a thing more powerful than I. He's on his way to standing up. It's indispensable. It isn't a step that we take every day. It's an awareness that we deepen constantly. I can't drink. Your life had not become unmanageable. You didn't lose jobs or were committed or arrested. You never fought publicly. You never embarrassed your family in public, so your life wasn't unmanageable. Use what is left of your think tank and think back on the days when you drank. Alcohol controlled my mind. It controlled my mind. It dictated my choice of friends. It dictated where I went and when. It dictated what I thought about. The alcoholic's reality is alcohol. Alcohol. It's the only thing that makes sense to him. Ask an alcoholic this question. What would you do to an enemy who robbed you of your wife, your children, your self-respect, your money, your job, everything? I'd kill him. How about alcohol? She's done all these things. And the answer, it's all I've got. What do I do in this perfectly hopeless state? I can't handle it. If I continue to try, it will kill me. I walk into a room full of people who said the same thing, but they're not drinking. And here's a man hadn't drunk for 10 years, another 8, another 6, another 19. So how'd you do it? They say, well, I came to believe that since it wasn't in me, that a power greater than I am could. Oh. I quit fighting now. It doesn't say I came to believe in God or came to believe in a power greater than myself. It says I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I get, what are you trying to say to me? God, I resented that word. Don't let it frighten you. I heard Bill Wilson say from his own lips, a kleptomaniac is one who steals but without freedom. It isn't his fault. And we call him a sick man. He's picked up time and time and time again, and the judge finally says, if you steal anything else, I'll throw you in jail. You're on probation now. And the fellow says, thank you, Your Honor. Walks out of the court, down the street, into the five and dime, and picks up a nickel package of bobby pins. That is insanity. In what sense? In this sense. Sickness of mind. That's all. The ancients had an expression, mens sana in corpore sano, a sound mind in a sound body. What do you mean by sound? Healthy. And you just heard the word, sana in corpore sano. That's the root word from which we get two English words, physical health, sanitation, mental health, sanity. All it means is soundness or health. Now, if I say that alcoholism is a disease or an illness of body, mind, and soul brought about by excessive uncontrolled drinking, then sanity or sobriety is health of body, mind, and soul. That's all it means. A healthy mind. Face it, we've been living on our emotions all our drinking lives. And I was told that it takes a minimum of 2 years for your think tank to function properly and normally again from your last drink. 2 years. I didn't want to hear that. Now, if you don't believe it, stay sober 5 and look back on them and prove me wrong. All right, now what do I do? Hope now has been born. I admitted I couldn't handle it. I have to, look, I've got to come to believe that a power greater than I can do it because I'm looking at sober people. And they're doing it. And they said we made a decision to turn our lives over to them. Oh. Now, but notice the psychology, the knowledge of human nature all through these 12 steps. The preparation and then the doing. The preparation and then the doing. I admitted I was wrong, then I came to believe. I made a decision, and then I tried to carry it out. Now, many people have a wacky idea of what it means to turn their lives over to God. Love is not so much the fact that two people gaze into each other's eyes, but the fact they gaze in the same direction. I find out what God's will is, and then I try to conform mine to it. In other words, there's a job for him to do and a job for me to do. He provides the strength, and I use it. It's really not a 50-50 proposition either. I pray as if everything had depended on God, and I act as if everything depended on me. So, I cannot have the attitude, well, all right, God, you're up there, handle this thing. And then sit back and watch him make you sober. He put 3.5 pounds in this pocket and 2. He doesn't work that way at all. It's like a little teeny kid. He's afraid of the dark. He lived on a farm with his mother. And one evening after supper, she said, we forgot to bring the paper in. Go out and get it. Well, it was pitch black out there. And the little kid kind of dragged his feet and so on. Finally, she got sore. She said, go out and get the paper. And he finally told her, he said, I'm scared. She said, of what? He said, the dark. Oh, well, she said, I can understand that, but all you have to do is remember that God is everywhere. He's out there. Nothing will happen to you. So the kid opened the door, stuck his hand out, and asked God to hand him the paper. Oh. Hey, he was the same one that night when he went up to bed. He was kneeling down saying his prayers, and he's kind of bored and everything. He's looking under the bed. He said, hey, Mom. She said, what? He said, is it true that we come from dust? She said, yeah. He said, after we die, do we go back into dust? She said, yeah. He said, well, there's about 8 guys under the bed, and I don't know whether they're coming or going. Yeah, it's funny. You get up here talking after a while, and then everybody looks so serious, you know. You got all those beady eyes focused on you. I begin to get scared. I don't know what you're thinking. I got tossed one of those out. One that Dave likes, and before I forget, I got a good memory, but it's short. There was a plane load of people took off on an Alitalia ship from LaGuardia, and they were going to Rome. And they're airborne about an hour and a half when the swoosh of the PA system came on, and you hear this voice. He said, "Hello, and this is your pilot." He said, "We are welcoming you aboard the ship." He said, "In a few minutes," he said, "the pretty stewardess will come along and serve you a nice lunch, and we hope that you enjoy it. But before she comes, we've got two announcements to make. One's good or one's bad." So he said, "I think I'll give you the bad news first." He says, "The number one, we lost." He said, "I don't know where we go." But he said, "Announcement number two, this is good news." He said, "We're making a damn good time." It's the perfect picture of the alcoholic. He doesn't know where the hell he's going, but he's making good time getting there. See, there were a couple of... Well, there was a little Irish girl. She was, I don't know, about 7 or 8, and her mother put one of these real ruffled dresses on her. One of these things takes about 3.5 hours to iron. And this dear little thing went out in the backyard and did somersaults and got grass stains all over. God, the mother was sore and lazy. She said, "Now, you run up the confession, and you tell him just what a bad girl you've been and how disobedient." So she went in. She confessed doing somersaults on the lawn. The old man, he never heard of that. He says, "Ah, somersaults." She says, "What's them?" And she's trying to tell him. It's not registering. Well, he says, "Can you show me?" So she says, "Sure." She gets out in the church, starts somersaulting over the pews, see? And two old biddies, they come into church seeing what I'm just about blessing herself. She takes one look at this kid. She says, "Glory to God." She said, "Would you look at the penance he's given today and me without me drawers on?" Oh, God. I don't know why I get inspired every night. All right, now the fun steps are over. 1, 2, 3, I can't handle it, God can, so I think I'll let him. Now, I don't think you need that spelled out. I've heard this many a time from a guy sober 15, 20 years. "I don't care why I drank." Well, I'll tell you, you don't have to know why to get sober. But you better find out why in order to stay sober. And this is why Mr. Wilson and Dr. Smith put in steps 4 and 5. Know yourself is a basic tenet that mankind has told himself from the beginning. So we took a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves. They say, you know, like, look at your good points, too. Like what? And after all, why do you have to be searching and fearless? Don't they shine out? Now, the next step contains the clue. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. To admit something to God is fairly easy. I've never seen him, never shook hands with him, and I've never heard him scold me. I've heard that he might from other people, but it's not too hard to admit something to God. A little harder to admit something to yourself. Very hard. Many people go to their graves without it. Now, the next part has been variously interpreted. I take it as written. And to another, singular, another human being, singular. Whenever these steps are discussed at AA meetings, people waste your time by talking for 10 minutes as to why they haven't yet done them. I once heard a man say at an AA meeting, "I figure it's what I bear about myself around this table to all of you that constitutes my fifth step." And there was a fellow in our group, God, how I loved him. When he spoke, I listened. He said, "Well, I figure it's those things I don't dare mention around this table that constitute mine." I've got news for you. The fifth step was the single most difficult thing I have ever done in my life. This is not child's play. This separates the big girls from the little girls and the boys from the men. And with this step, I hear aloud what I am. Every one of us is three. I am who I think I am. I am who you think I am. And there's me. I get to know me by a good, hard, fearless, and searching look. And a lot of time. When should you take it? I don't know. The time will come. What's the value of it? I can't tell you. Do it and you'll know. It's that simple. Good God, if you could reason to the reasonableness of it, you'd do it. You're being asked to do it because it works. Look, we're all familiar with the two-steppers, the clowns that try to climb a ladder by stepping from 1 to 12. God, it doesn't make sense. They get sober. It's the first time they've drawn a sober breath regularly, 2 or 3 days in succession in 30 years. So you know what they do? They want to sober up the whole world. Great, they're running great guns, you know, a lot of fancy footwork, the heresy of action. You know what's wrong with that? They're going out playing with a sick human life, and they have nothing to give. No one gives what he doesn't have. And we'll talk about that 12th step shortly. So you know what happens? Nigh about the 8th or 9th, 12th step call, he goes on. There's some drunk says, have a drink. He says, no mind if I do. Then somebody's 12 steps to do with him. Once having taken the 5th step, my past is discharged, my present is secure, and all other things being equal, my future is assured. My past can never touch me again. Rip used to tell us, he said, if I were to walk into any big hotel lobby in the country, he said, there's liable to be some guy sitting there who could point to me and say, Ripley, you're an SOB. And he said, I would have to look him right in the face and say, yes, what you say was true. And so we come at least to a halfway knowledge of ourselves. And this knowledge is beautiful as it blossoms. You'll hear people at meetings say, well, I didn't know I had any faults, but at least now I'm aware of them. So are we. Somehow or other, being aware, he says, don't tell me you're aware of them. Tell me what you're doing to get rid of those things you're aware of so that I might follow in your footsteps and find out how to make myself a little better. How do we do it? The next 2 steps. Became willing. Notice all of this program, the preparation, then the doing, the preparation, and then the doing. And so we became willing. It's like the kid with his toe in the swimming pool. We've got to test it first, and then we jump in. Anyhow, we become willing to have God remove these defects of character. And kids, if you're anything like me, your defects have character. And the only bit of advice I can give you is, if you don't want them removed, don't ask. Don't ask. Because he'll perform spiritual surgery on you that you might not get over in a hurry. Humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. He will do it his way. Just as he got us sober, his way. You don't know what God's will is? You can go to your grave knowing only that he wills your sobriety. His way through these 12 steps. Through these 12 steps. How often have you heard a man or woman, or how often have you been that man or woman who tears into an AA meeting at night and says, boy, I had a rotten day. I really need this meeting. And it was probably the best day of your life. I got news for you. The good days are nothing but breathers between the rounds. Life is tough. Look, it's easy to stay sober when it's easy. It's easy to be good when it's easy. A little bit of spiritual advice. The easiest way to get rid of a temptation is to give in to it. No, I forget that. Forget I said that. But it is, it's awfully easy to be good when it's easy. The day that is filled with frustrations, insults, near panic, that's the best day of your life. He's answering your prayers. He's giving you opportunities to work the program. It's the good days you'd better beware of, because I have found in my own life the only thing that can come near alcohol in being insidious and cunning and baffling and all-embracing is complacency. It's alcohol's only rival. It's the one thing we must beware of. And so I thank God for the bad days. In my book, real spiritual maturity is when I can begin to thank God for pain. I'm a little leery about talking about that, because every time I talk about pain, I get a truckload of it. There's a man in Boston, got sober, and his wife divorced him. And he went to see his mother. He said, good God, I finally found the answer, and she's divorcing me. The mother said, maybe it's a blessing. He said, good Lord, why is it every time I get a blessing, it's wrapped up in a brickbat? And his mother said this, I didn't know they came any other way. How often have I heard it said, I don't thank God for my alcoholism, but I thank him for being in AA. My God, it's like the little kid who thanks God for the ice cream cone, because that's a nice thing, but doesn't thank him for having to earn the nickel to pay for it. God. Why do I think that blessings are just goodies? Did it ever dawn on me that pain might be a blessing? Controversy, but whether or not you're grateful for your alcoholism or not, whether you're grateful for AA or whatever, put it this way. I'm grateful to God for enabling me to pay the price to buy the ticket to get into this room. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Notice the willingness and then the execution. Here is where the aid of sensible people, a good sponsor, will help you. Because the next step says, made direct amends to them all, except where to do so would injure them or others. My God, I had to make an amends to a priest whose wine I drank after Mass to the tune of about a case over many months. 8 years after I was sober, I felt like a jackass. However, just a hint, and I learned this in the beginning, and it helped me immeasurably. I have sat around AA tables and heard people tell others, do it, it will make you feel good. It's like dangling candy in front of a child. I don't make amends because I'll feel good. If I feel good having made an amend, that's bonus, that's gravy. Do you know why I make amends? Because I should. My God, it's that simple. It's a question of justice. You know, it's one thing to stand on the piano and lead the singing at a New Year's Eve party, but it's another thing to go into your neighbor's house on Saturday afternoon after the 19th hole and hop on his piano in your golf shoes and puke all over his rug. And whether you're blacked out and don't remember, it has nothing to do with it. It doesn't say, became willing to make amends to those people that I willingly harmed or knowingly harmed. It just said that I had harmed. Let me put it this way. Here's a kid who accidentally knocks a baseball through a neighbor's window. He did not will to do damage. So he goes over to her and he says, I'm sorry. She says, you're forgiven. That'll be $4.98. The same way here. Now, I got that notion. You don't do it because it makes you feel good. You do it because you're supposed to, from Rip. He used to write for Look magazine, and he gave them an unholy fit when he was drinking. And when he got well, he went back to apologize to them. And Look, as you know, has an entire building in New York, and he started from the top floor down apologizing. Everybody's saying, forget it. Good Lord, it's wonderful to see you sober and happy and productive and functioning again. This is wonderful, except one man. So he's halfway down the building, went into his office. Now, this is a direct quote. Rip went in. The man didn't invite him to sit down. He sat there sucking on his pipe, and this is exactly what he said. When Rip finished his spiel, he said, Ripley, you were a son of a bitch then, and you're one now. Get the hell out of my office. Rip went out blazing mad, blazing. And he said, I walked down toward the elevator, shaking. And he said, I pressed the button, and as I waited for it, he said, this thought struck me. That man did not have to accept my apology. I had to give it. These are the antics of a man. That step doesn't say, except where to do so would embarrass me. You see, these are things that husbands and wives can't cover up for us anymore. These are things we must do ourselves. This is the guts of the program, these middle steps. Continue to take personal inventory, and when wrong, promptly admit it. Many people think this is interpersonal relationships. My God, you can be wrong in the solitude of your own room by making a rash judgment in your own mind. It's an admission to God and yourself that has to be made here. And then we're told to pray. God, how difficult that is for us. And yet, very briefly, just to put a reasonable basis under prayer, it's not a pietistic, sloppy something. It's the most human thing you can do. See this picture? It resembles God. You know why? It is. God is and it is. At least they enjoy that in common. A blade of grass more closely resembles God because it has life. Animal life is even more refined than vegetable life, and human life is the noblest of all. It's highest on the hierarchy of beings because we're made to the image and likeness of God. We have minds and wills. When I use my mind and I use my will, I resemble God, even though I use it for evil. But when I use it for what He uses it for, I most closely resemble God and most fully fulfill my nature.
Well, what does he think about and love? What does he use his mind and will on? Himself. He knows and loves himself from all eternity because he's the perfect being. And when I focus my attention on God and love him, that's prayer. So prayer is the most reasonable thing we can do. And yet I find that many of us are well-schooled in whatever our profession is, and we're children as far as the spiritual life goes. And so we learn. I have this to offer you because I have found that it has worked for me. Pick a time which will be the same each day. It may be a little more difficult one day than another, but pick the time which is most conducive to it each day. Most of us can't pray for a half hour, an hour. When I first went to seminary, I couldn't understand these guys going to sleep between 6 and 6:30 a.m., you know. Here's all this new stuff, you know, and I'm meditating and dreaming and praying. After about 3 months, I found out real easy how I could go to sleep. So pick a time of the day when you can do it. Make it only for 2 or 3 minutes, as long as it's effective. And I would suggest using some kind of help. That little 24-hour-a-day book is, I wouldn't be without it. Now, for those who argue as to what's the best kind of prayer, I say this. Would you wear tennis shoes to a banquet or a tuxedo to the beach? Prayer is different because there are different needs. It isn't that one is better than another. It's one is more suited than another at this time or this place. I once knew a priest used to smoke his pipe while he said his breviary, and somebody said, well, who ever heard of smoking while you pray? He thought, well, he said, I don't know, but I don't think God is too insulted if you pray while you smoke. You know, it's all in the point of view. We have formulated prayer, the Our Father. We recite it at the end of every AA meeting. The Serenity Prayer, a formula of prayer we recite at the beginning. Some people say, well, I find the only good prayer, and I discovered in AA, is conversation with God. There's other prayer in which not a word is spoken. Heart to heart speaks in silence. So that some kind of prayer is good at some times, other kinds at another. And then we come to the crowning of our program. Please notice the wording of the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result. It doesn't say a result. It says as the result of these steps. That's what all 11 of these steps point toward. The spiritual awakening. And what does it mean? Bill Wilson told us this. He said, look at yourself now and look at yourself in the middle of your last drunk. Do you see a change? If there is one, as a result of trying to work this program, you have had a spiritual awakening. Normally, it will be a very gradual thing that you won't even be aware of yourself. Then it says, sought to carry the message to other alcoholics. Now I go out and try to help somebody after I've done or continue to perform these 11 steps. It's only then that in fear and trepidation, I take it out to others and try to practice these principles in all our affairs, try to apply the principles of AA to our whole life. Many years ago, you know why AA works? Simplest reason in the world. Bill Wilson dared to dream the impossible dream. He fought the unbeatable foe, bore with unbearable sorrow, and ran where the brave dared not go. With his last ounce of courage, he reached the unreachable star, the precious, priceless crown of sobriety. But he was a man different from all men who came before him, because having achieved and gained what he sought, he then really acted like God. You know the greatest mystery of the universe? Why did God create? If he was all perfection, why did he create? And the only answer the theologians and philosophers can come up with is goodness tends to diffuse itself. He created other knowledgeable beings who could know his goodness and love him too. And so Bill Wilson did what no other man had done before him. He wished to share his gift. And in the doing, he saved our lives, but primarily his own. How often have I heard talks on gratitude in which the speaker will do nothing but list what I have to be grateful for. God in heaven, we've all got things to be grateful for, like my life through sobriety, my family through sobriety, my health through sobriety. And this is why I can hardly abide people who, once they get a little comfortable in AA, say, well, actually, now you see, sobriety is secondary. Look at all these goodies that follow. They're all based on sobriety. When we show up at an AA meeting, we come for one reason. Alcohol brings us here. Alcohol. Sobriety is why I am here. The rest is incidental. If the good God chose that I should spend the rest of my life in prison but remain sober, that's the name of the game. The greatest thing that can be said of any alcoholic is he died sober. Not happy, not jumping, not with family reunited. He died sober. This is what our program is geared toward. All of those other things, yes, but in their place. First things come first. Sobriety is the name of the game. And I must be grateful for it. How? I don't know. God, how I envy people who stand up and say, I'm a grateful alcoholic. How I truly envy people who say I work these steps to the best of my ability. As God is my judge, I don't think I've done anything to the best of my ability. And I must never shortchange my abilities or talents. The person who poo-poos his gifts is insulting God. You ever go to a party and you know there's some clown there that plays the piano and say, we'd like to sing, would you play? And he says, oh, I don't play very well. And you say, oh, excuse me, I thought you did. Try that one on him the next time. You see the tongue drop down to his belly button. He's there waiting, you know, waiting to be begged. God. And this is humility? It's phoniness. I don't even know what humility is. I'll never be humble. They say the one characteristic of humility is that the man who has it is the last to know it. I only hope to God I'm less proud on my deathbed. And probably it'll take that to do it. And so it's hard to be grateful. I actually fear for my lack of gratitude. And that is why I say a three-word prayer every single morning after communion at Mass. I don't even put a please on it. Make me grateful. If one can command a God, I try. Ingratitude is the most repulsive of human characteristics. Is this not true that we turn aside from a child who is an ingrate, and it isn't even his fault because he hasn't been raised properly? A child who doesn't say thanks is just repulsive. It's not his fault. Ingratitude has been called the halitosis of the soul. It makes God turn his head aside. The ingrate tries to see how high he can reach to get instead of how low he can stoop to give. It's been called the paschal candle of the cathedral of the human soul. It's what gives us light and warmth from within. The most beautiful definition of gratitude I've ever heard was Rip's. It's the golden tray on which I give to others what God has given to me, and it's the one thing on which your sobriety hinges. Sobriety is the virtue of the human because it is the virtue of a receiver, one who has gotten. And I must be ever grateful. And so I beg him to make me so. Well, it sounds like the end of a beautiful story, but it isn't. I got sobriety the easiest way possible, and I always maintained that it was handed to me on a golden platter. And it was. And after he thought that I had attended a decade of meetings and perhaps had learned a little bit of something about AA and its principles of living, the good Lord then whispered very quietly that he was now going to ask me the price. But he whispered so low and I was so busy that I didn't hear him. 2 years ago, my teaching career came to an end. And so I was just in residence at the seminary where I lived, doing parish work on Sundays and AA work in the middle. There was no direction to my life. There was no real schedule. And one thing I did find out, I am not a very inventive person. I don't know quite how to use my time right. Anyway, here's what I mean by complacency and sobriety being taken for granted. Or complacency sneaking up on you and taking your sobriety for granted. I began to live opposite to what most people do. I was staying awake at nights and trying to sleep my days away. And then I would like to speak to you now of medication and what it can do. This past summer, I got to using the pills just to sleep. I never once sought a thrill from medicine, ever. Thank God for that. And it wasn't until the end of a summer in which depression had set in that a young friend of mine said, "Father, are you addicted to them?" And I had sense enough left to know the one question to ask myself: are they causing problems? And the answer was yes, because what makes problems is one. And then, thank God, I knew what to do about it. But before that, I'd like to tell you something of depression. At the end of his own first 12 years of sobriety, Bill Wilson went into a 5-year period of depression. Oh, I don't mean having a bad day or where everything is gloomy. I mean this god-awful, indefinable thing that you can actually touch, where everything is bleak. Everything is bleak. Where you cry and sob by the hour. Where you are so afraid that the only reality in your life is fear. And you're afraid to get well because you don't know what good health will be like, and so you cling to your fear because that's all you have. Despair is one thing in the pages of a theology textbook, and it's another thing in the pit of your guts. What brings you out of it? God only knows, and he won't tell. He does it in his own way. It's not because you're off your program. I don't think Bill was off of his. You know what I have come to believe about pain? Nothing but good comes from everything. And I know now that whenever I hurt, physically, mentally, emotionally, any way at all, it is nothing but the dear Lord trying to put his arms around me. Because you see, if I didn't believe that, God knows. We sought medical help, and the doctor put me on medication for the idea was that it would be for about 3 or 4 months, and I knew in my heart that it had to be for no time at all, so I stopped. Nothing at all. And I shook and I cried, and I shook and I cried. But it gets better. The only thing that I tell you this for, you know, I often tell some people who ask, don't ever say anything at an AA meeting that doesn't have a purpose to it. And so I tell you all this for a purpose. God let me learn a beautiful lesson from this, and nothing but good has come from it. And I'll tell you what it is. I firmly believe that the medical profession should realize a simple fact. As a general principle, I believe it to be wrong to give an addict any addictive substance. It seems that this makes sense. Secondly, if necessary, and face it, God created medication just as he created alcohol. Alcohol is not bad because we got sick from it. Medication should be taken under strict supervision in a hospital setting, whereby the nurse gives the medication, watches you take it, and leaves the room. And it should be for the shortest possible term. The shortest possible term. Well, doctor, I'm shaking. Well, damn it, shake. You won't die. I know that this is an ill. It's a cancer in AA today, when a young friend of mine says, "My God, Father, I see them trading pills at AA meetings." I beg you, flush every pill you own down the toilet unless you are under the care of a knowledgeable doctor and you absolutely need it. I don't mean to sound like I'm preaching. This really is just something I feel inside. It may sound wrong coming out. I would offer this. If I can give you anything, and I'm going to break the rule by giving it to you, never give advice. Now, I'll tell you what I mean by that. Never give advice unless it is asked for, and then only reluctantly. Now, this collar has put me in the advice-giving business, and I've been in it for a long time. but I've learned a few things the hard, hard way. Now, why do I say that? Based on a little story narrated by Father Fowle, I heard him say one time, a woman got out of the hospital after having been beaten up by her husband, and she said, you know, I don't know what to do anymore. She said, the beatings are worse. She said, I had to go to the hospital this time, and I'm scared for my life. He said, leave him. She said, you know, Father, many years ago, I threatened to do that several times, and each time he said, if you do, I'll kill myself. Father Fowle said, if you stay with him, he'll kill you. So she left, and he killed himself. Now, in a sense, that's neither here nor there. You know, I know, Father Fowle knew, and the woman knew that it wasn't their fault. But that doesn't make any difference when you go the rest of your life knowing that somebody died under those circumstances. Do you know how I have learned to give advice? I give it, but this is the way I give it. Most people do not come seeking advice. They come seeking backing. See, here's a husband and wife. They're having a problem. Well, I know, let's go to him. He'll tell us what they mean. He's going to tell you off, pal. He's going to back me up. He's thinking the same thing. Now, there are three sides to every argument. Your side, his side, and the right side. Now, you remember what we said about point of view, how it can get all slopped up. You know, who called that SOB a piccolo player? That's the way stories are told, from one's point of view. So after a story is all finished, and I see it the way it is told, here is what I say. Based on what you have told me, here's what I think I would do. Don't we call this a family disease? Aren't the people who live with alcoholism sick? Don't they want decisions made for them? And who will they blame for decisions that go wrong? And the decisions go wrong because they don't fulfill them as you give them. Leave the decision-making up to them. Now, I'll give you a perfect for instance of exactly what I mean. Lady called me on the phone back, I don't know, 2-3 months ago. Father, such and such and so, and on and on and on. So I said, well, from what you have said, here's what I think I'd do. What, is that what you want me to do? I said, I didn't say that at all. I said, your decision will be yours. You will do what you will do. But here's what I would do. What you mean that you want me to do this? I said, I didn't say that at all. I don't want you to do anything. But you have asked me a question. I'm giving you the answer. This is what I would do. You know, after the 8th time, she got sore. She did. She really got sore. She wanted a decision made for her. And this had to do with the future of a family that I'd never even met. And yet, how often do we try to make decisions that will seriously affect the lives of other people? So I can just leave you with that, especially those of you who are in Al-Anon, because you find more queen bees in Al-Anon than the man in the moon, with the sum total of the experience of having lived with one alcoholic. Very often we try to dictate and tell others how it should be done with another alcoholic that perhaps we don't even know. This is not a criticism. It's a thought to be chewed on. I am indeed grateful for the pain that the good Lord has seen fit to give me, because the crown comes only through the cross, and it is pain that buys pleasure. And so, my parting wish for you is a simple one. I think it's based on reality. I do not wish you joy without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you love and faith and strength and wisdom, goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. I will close by letting you in on a secret. I'm the wealthiest man in this room. You see, God, in his goodness, through AA, has given me all of you.